You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Well, hello, Scott, and how are you on this? What is the 21st Adoption and Fostering Podcast? What's it?
Podcast, what's it? Are we extending the name? I'm fine, thank you. How are you, Al?
I am very well. It's that week of the year, isn't it, where we're kind of running into the end of school.
I feel like it's been a couple of weeks like that, actually. Yeah. I think because both of us have got year six, well, they're now year sevens from today.
Don't start, I'll be filling
children
up.
Who've left primary school today.
Yes.
I know. Oh, I tell you, I've had it all today. But
We've had to put Mrs. Coates on Valium.
Again,
just to get her through the...
Just the wine just
today.
Wasn't cutting it tonight. but I think kind of the climax is now here, isn't it? The day has gone and it's finished. And yeah, I think the kind of leading up to it, I don't know about you, but for us, it's been really tricky and trickier than the other two kind of transitioning to high school, you know, the finish in the primary school. He's been a lot more emotional and a lot more not wanting it and stuff. So it's been hard.
It's kind of that crushing inevitability of it. You can't get out of it, can you? You've got to somehow negotiate it and make the best of all that uncertainty.
Yeah.
Lottie's been fine, to be honest with you. She fizzes a bit. So she's been fizzing a little bit, but we've had a bit of a sass levels have peaked.
I love that, her sass level.
Yes, she's an Olympian sass girl, but she was trying to eat candy floss at 10:30 last night because she'd come back from her prom, and it was kind of like, this is only going to end really badly, and it took 24 hours, but she's fine. And negotiate the summer, but then all of a sudden you've got all of that, and then now you've got 6 weeks where you've got to manage all that comes with that spare time. And
I think I'm quite lucky in that respect, and what I mean by that is the fact I am the worker in the house, as in I go out to work, not that I'm the worker, you know, the only person that does it.
I know what you're saying.
So therefore, for probably 3 or 4 days a week, I will not be in the house. I'll be out of work, so I don't have to really change my routine as such. Might have to come home a bit earlier now and again, you know.
That brings its own unique pressures, and I think that often, I think very carefully say that because I'm aware that we may get lynched. But I think sometimes not being present in the moment of crisis can be uniquely challenging. Mm. And there's many times I've sat on the end of a phone thinking, I just don't know what to do. And literally World War III is happening on the other end of a phone line. And that's stressful. It's, you know, you're not in the midst of it all. You know, maybe you're not fielding all the language and words and blows. But
I know. Yeah. Although, I'm lucky enough to have done that with the older two.
Of course.
So our roles are swapped. So I get that. But of course, you know, when Trish rings me up and says, this has happened, that's happened, I'm like, okay, so deal with it.
And your point is?
You know, but obviously, exactly. But he deals with stuff very differently to me. And I find myself then worrying the rest of the day about, you know, what's going on at home. And, you know, because, like I say, we deal with stuff very differently. So I might not get as stressed out as he does about things and vice versa. So,
when you're trying to maintain
funny old world
professional facade, you know, while you're looking under the desk at texts going, child X says now done, why? And you kind of go, yes, and then you talk, erudite conversations with high-level professionals. And then inside, you're freaking out. But hey, that's just a window into our summer holidays. I'm sure we'll return to that topic.
Exactly.
We're
looking forward to that.
That'll be a laugh, won't it? Right, we did the CPV talk. Was it last week?
I think it was was it 6 months ago? It feels like it was a long time ago now, actually.
It was, when we were young and happy.
It was last Wednesday?
It was.
Yeah,
so,
well.
Right. How did you think it went? Tell me your thoughts.
Well, I think the main thing was that I enjoyed it.
As long as you're happy,
Yeah, exactly. As long as I'm happy, then the world is a lovely place. I think that the majority of the audience enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I like to think that we gave them an insight into some of the things that we could share as a community with each other. I think we gave them an insight into some of the kind of, not necessarily solutions, but some options that maybe some hadn't spoken about or maybe hadn't thought about. But there was, I mean, you'll remember there was one lady there who had tried everything that we were coming up with. And I think I was a bit disappointed in myself that I didn't come up with anything new for her, if that makes sense. Yeah. Because I hated that someone went away. And maybe she left feeling a bit lighter that, you know, she'd heard other people who've gone through the same thing, but we hadn't been able to give her any new kind of strategies or, you know, coping mechanisms or anything like that.
If that rings true with me, because I came away sort of feeling that as well. I thought actually that I feel that that was probably the shortest bit of what we talked about, where more of, about what to do, strategies, plans, hopes, different interventions. But I think in reality that reflects what's out there. There's limited knowledge of what works and what helps. But like I was generally encouraged.
I'd agree. It was good.
It was a good turnout as well.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I think it was predominantly adopters, wasn't it? Maybe 90-95% adopters. But I think that it kind of acknowledges the fact that people are just wanting to sit in a room and go, actually, this happens. And that's a forum that hasn't necessarily been provided previously.
No, I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And there was a little bit of a fracas, wasn't there, at halftime? Is fracas too strong a word for it?
I think it's a bit of a strong word, although, you know, I didn't have to adjust my shirt collar after they'd finished with me, but, you know.
You were very gracious. tell us
Go
what
on.
Happened.
All three listeners.
Yes. Tell my mother.
Tell Claire Nails what happened.
Yeah. Well, you were spoken to by, there was a small contingent of social workers, and they sent a brave representative to talk to you at halftime, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I think the lady that approached me was probably the messenger, because she was quite cool about the whole thing, but they did feel that in the first half we'd done a bit of social work bashing. And the part where they felt they were social work bashed was the part where we talked about prep groups. And in general, there'd been a lack of information about things like CPV in prep groups. I think there was three social workers that felt a little bit miffed by that, even though it was a generalization. It was. And I think that the majority of the audience agreed with us on that.
We were talking historically as well, weren't we? You know, I'm talking back.
Yeah.
My prep group, the only prep group I've ever been was 1998.
2006 or 5 or something.
I listened back and I could see it, but I kind of thought actually it's made me think about social workers in general, and I kind of find myself in two camps, but on a few occasions I've been I've been accused of being anti-social workers, which I find quite odd.
Well, I find that quite odd as well, because, well, number one, you are one.
It's that and, self-hatred coming out again.
You wouldn't do it if you didn't want to do it. But secondly, I work with a lot of social workers day in, day out. And, you know, whether they're team managers or, you know, whatever they are within local authorities and voluntary agencies and all that sort of stuff. And I have nothing but, you know, bar a very, very small minority who maybe, you know, don't see what we see as people who live it. I have a very positive relationship with all the social workers that I come in contact with, and I have the utmost respect for them. I think that where their the sector is struggling is with statutory kind of bits and pieces that come with it, because they can't really change that. But, you know, on the whole, I yeah
Yeah.
I have a very positive experience of social workers.
But I am conscious that it's a voice in our kind of sphere that as adopters, the Twitter sphere, the adopters have quite a clear voice. There's a clear kind of cohort of adopters. Yeah. There's perhaps a smaller side of foster carers. Then there's a tiny slither of birth parents that are out there. There's adoptees. But actually, there's very few social work voices. And what social work voices are usually anonymous. They're usually kind of more watching than participating. There are a few that do. Yeah. And I just thought that's interesting about perhaps the state of how social workers feel about their role and about their professionalism and stuff. And I kind of get that. But having listened back to what we'd said, I kind of thought, well, actually, what did we say? You know, what was inflammatory? And I think we reflected afterwards that we'd not, you know, I've got social work stories that would take, you know, would blister paint in a negative sense. And like a lot of people, and I didn't go there. And, you know, I can walk into a room and I can inflame people with my social work stories. But actually, that wasn't what we did, because I don't want to do that, because I think that's not helpful. It's not true, actually. I think there's more social work.
No, it's not. And the subject that we're talking about, you know, what is, you know, a social worker, for three social workers to come and sit and listen to what we had to say, it means that they have an interest in that topic, whether it be because they're working with a family who's maybe experiencing it, or they've been aware of it for some time, or they were, you know, trying to do something as part of their kind of their development. But the point is that they came along to listen. And definitely the kind of discussion that we had was more about the state of the nation when it comes to CPV.
Yeah, and we
not about how particular social workers are dealing with it.
No, we did reflect on the services that people have gone to and the response that they got. But that was, we talked broadly across lots of services: education, health, police, social care. So it was interesting, but it kind of made me think a bit wider about actually. In a lot of contexts, we don't hear that voice. And I think we're poorer for not having that voice, because actually social workers, I know social workers, have done adoption for 30 years. And, you know, they know their stuff. They've got a lot of insight in their ethics and their values. And it was something around what the BASWA Adoption Inquiry was doing, trying to get that knowledge and rake it into the conversation. But it doesn't happen in this context, which is quite sad, really. I think we're a bit, we could do without those voices sometimes to moderate us. But,
I'd agree.
I love it when you agree. Right.
I'm just doing it because I'm fed up talking about it.
That's fine. Fair enough. You're a funny, funny man. There's another few things. There's a lot of opportunities have opened up because of it, haven't they? We're now being invited to. You will probably hold those things in your mind more. Where have we been invited now to go? In relation to doing this?
We've been asked. We've been asked to visit some parts of the world to kind of, I guess, Well, we joked about the Scott and Al Roadshow, didn't we? But actually, we have been asked to go to two specific areas, and I'm glad you said that, actually, because, you know, I think that three specific areas, and so far I've agreed to one, and we're trying to get some kind of help with some travel expenses so we can get there, but, you know, that's we've said this before, but, you know, we're quite happy to go and do it for free if we've got a venue that's free, and you know, if we can get there. So yeah, we've got three more events, if you like, of Scott and Al Roadshow, or should we call it CPV Roadshow?
CPV, I don't know. Roadshow. I think the frustration for me, it's a slight frustration, is that I really want to get the ball rolling around awareness and just actually openness, that it's part of the narrative of adoption now. But actually, there's only two of us.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy when I see people I see things popping up. I've been invited to do a speak at a conference in London in whenever, November sometime. I'm doing something next month with After Adoption in Gateshead, which is too far. But actually, the limiting factor is we're doing all this in our spare time, aren't we? You know, we're working on the good grace of our employers.
I'm keen to get a message out that we are not, you know, we are not being paid to do this. We are doing it as us. And you know, your employer isn't paying you, and my employer isn't paying me. We're, you know, we're doing this off our own back.
But we, our family, did provide refreshments. I have to confess, they were very generous. Well, Marie Louise provided refreshments
with the water.
A lot of water.
Exactly. And then you had a little refreshment afterwards, didn't you, Mr. Cole?
I did, and I. But Zippy escorted me home, so it was all okay. I cycled into central London. It was such a warm night. And I cycled back out, which I know is really, really boring. But Zippy and I cycled, and it was midnight, and we went to an all-night bagel shop, and I had a Bakewell tart, which is, you know, but it was really interesting.
Yeah.
I think we're way off adoption now, aren't we? Me cycling.
And I think it's but can we just confirm that you didn't drink and cycle? You had one pint.
Well, I didn't even finish a pint.
Exactly. And he was tripper, let's put it that way.
I was at one with the world, I feel. I think that's how we could put it. my zen was in place. Right.
I'm sure it's not. No. Well, so it I'll tell a shandy. You, I did say a shandy.
Say a shandy. Harmless fizzy pop. Right, I'll tell you what I did. We recorded the talk, and then I listened back to it. And what I realised was that we'd not wanted to do a formal lecture, had we? We'd really been keen that it was a very informal, people asking questions as we went. But what I'm conscious of is that perhaps those people would not want to be identified, because some of the questions are quite specific, and you know, you can tell people's voices. And so at the beginning we said, this is confidential. If you tell something, it's an environment we're not going to share. So what I've done is I've bleeped things out, or I've put comedy musical noises over certain aspects of it. But I've also taken out stuff that we've said about our own families, our own circumstances, and our own stories. So in some ways listening back, it feels a little bit disjointed in places, but it gets the essence of the first half of what we did. And so you've listened to it. Did that make sense to you?
Yeah, I just, hard one to reflect on, because I hate listening to myself. So it was like cringe every time I heard myself, but I think that actually when you listen to it, you'll get a sense that you're there, because I thought it was very interactive actually when I listened to it back. I didn't realize just how much we'd engaged with everybody, but I hope that's how it comes across. It did to me, definitely. And I think that when we were talking in that room, and we were talking about our own families, obviously we knew we were recording ourselves, but you're right that, you know, if we'd all three listeners, it's a different audience, and it is literally putting it out very, very publicly. Now, I don't mind talking about my family publicly. I've done it for the last 11 years, but some of the stuff is quite, it's quite open and honest, and so I think you're right to do what you've done. So,
And I looked and I cut out almost 25 minutes. So in an hour's talk, it was 25 minutes that was reduced. But there is the second half, and if I get time, I'm gonna I'll edit that together. But I think I'm happy to go with that as it is. So shall we put it on, and we'll not do an outro, we'll just let it fade out, shall we? Would that sound fair?
Yeah
We'll not do an outro.
Yes.
If you give me hang on, Paula's coming. Paula's gone out. She looks like a woman on a mission.
Hi Paula.
She's gone. She looks at me with abject horror. Don't say that. If she listens, she's going to kill me. No.
She won't till next year, and it'll be gone by then. So.
I'll be okay. So I'm going to bid you farewell, and I hope you have a lovely evening, and I shall speak to you soon.
Yes, see you soon. Have a lovely few weeks. However long until we speak again.
For sure. Okay, goodbye. Ta-ta.
Experiences. You're a professional. I'm not.
In the broader sense of the term.
Yeah, but actually, we found that what we had in common, we had a very similar trail of thought on, and that's where we're kind of trying to do not road shows. We joke about it online, say that we're doing a CPV roadshow. We're not doing a CPV roadshow, but what we are doing is trying to give access to kind of peer-led information about CPV, because actually we both feel that this is the kind of stuff that people should be able to access for free. They shouldn't have to pay for it. It should be there. It should be available. So here we sit tonight.
Go on. So CPV, which is child-to-parent violence, which I'm presuming that everyone is familiar with that, those three letters, and that's the letters we're going to use, CPV, it's shorthand. I'm not particularly happy with that definition, but we'll move on to that. It's arguably the most under-researched form of family violence, despite an extremely high rate of occurrence and increasing prevalence. I'd never heard of it. Who here before, perhaps, well, actually, we'll move on. Use the clicker, the clicker. Ah, so the aims of today, firstly, is to kind of get our heads around what does that mean, child-to-parent violence? What is the definition? What, you know, what are we talking about? To develop our understanding of the causes, you know, what, why is it prevalent in certain groups of children, certain cohorts? Look at you. To understand, actually, how much is there, because I thought to myself, let's read up on this. And there's just a big empty gap. So I've kind of, part of what we've done and I've done, and with Dr. Wendy Thorley, who's kind of the unseen person in the room who's done a lot of work and written up the reports and helped me with the survey that I did, is to say, actually, how common is this? Because if you go and sit in a support group, what do you hear? You say, sometimes my children are violent. And people go, ah, and then the conversation ensues. Oh, he's on fire. To develop our understanding of the impacts, actually, what does that do to people? Rather than just say, well, it makes me feel this way, we tried to quantify it. So it's an idea, getting an idea of what people are saying and what a group of people said to me. And to kind of think about an appropriate response. Okay, right. First slide, please, Scott. You know what's going to happen now. Right, can I just have a really straw poll? Well, get an idea of... Do we have, you don't, maybe people don't want to self-identify, not like us, blatant show-offs, but are there any adopters in the room? Just, whoa, too much information. Right, that changes everything.
It does.
That changes everything, right. Are there any social workers in the room? Hey, social workers.
That changes everything.
That,
goodbye.
Right, yeah. Are there any sort of therapeutic practitioners? Don't be shy. Don't be shy. Yeah.
Foster carers?
Yeah. Kinship carers? Any?
Special guardians?
Oh. Well, that makes sense. It's, you know, we have families predominantly adopted. We're fishing from an adoption pool, aren't we, today? So that's cool. This sounds like a really obvious question. What? Why are you here?
Does anybody want to tell us why they're here?
Free water. I guess there's a caveat is that actually this is quite a, once we start to share our stories, it becomes quite a different environment than just a lecture. So it's quite personal and people might share personal things. And I think that we've got, I would ask you kindly to respect people's privacy. I would also ask you kindly, if you don't want people to share it, don't tell it. You know, because I don't know any of you. I know you. And I kind of know you. And so actually, it is an open environment. So if you don't want people to share it, don't say it. But if you're comfortable sharing, that would really help the evening go by.
And practitioners, professionals, what? Anybody want to share why you guys are here?
I do.
Yeah?
We are running NVR groups, training groups, all over the country, actually, with MPAC.
Okay.
And his mission should be around just what the MPAC has done. So I want to see what you've got that's different, how it fits, how it merges, what's the best way to support our parents. We have parent graduates on our courses as well, so mm-hmm. I'll just keep growing the stuff.
Okay. Yeah. That's really encouraging. We've all been to conferences and heard fantastic, gone away with great intentions. But then, I mean, there might be some interest, some, how shall we say, flamboyant language. We might use some flamboyant language, because the reality is our children use flamboyant language. Language that they've never heard me say. My daughter laid on the floor on Friday night outside of my house and she screamed, And I went, on so many levels, that's wrong, right? But actually that feeling, how dare you? You little... We're outside in a public area. And that's the response you get. And you kind of go, I need to step away. And if you can, you know, it's really difficult, that actual response, being called names. I hate being called names. Well, we've probably done that one. Yep. We'll move on. Because we've got so many slides. And actually, there might be an element of we go off-piste a bit.
Really?
Off-piste, yeah. How do we define child and parent violence? Could you click up all the ones for this one? So, too far. How would we define child to parent violence? Because there are some definitions. If you look, the next slide shows the definitions. But I think that is actually really important, because how we define it decides whether people include themselves within that kind of category. Or some people may say, actually, I don't want to be part of that definition because I don't like the way it portrays my child. Because the complexity of this is that we still love our children. We may not like them, we may not like what they do, but we kind of love them. And that's why it's even more complicated, because she's calling me effing. So I think that the definition is really important. What I am conscious of, well, is that it's late in the day, it's a hot day, and we would like to have a break probably just after 8-ish. If you've got questions, we will have time for questions probably before the break and probably at the end as well. And we'll be milling around, because we're good at milling around, aren't we? We do loitering. Sorry?
With intent, loitering with intent.
Always. Oh, yeah. Always.
So can you move on to the next one? We've got a couple of definitions there. So here's a definition by Cottrell and Monk, and there's one last one at the bottom. Hey. Which is a really interesting one. 1979 was the first time it was recorded, parent battering. And frankly, that one really fits sometimes.
Yeah,
you know, I've been battered, you know. And sometimes it's a bit tricky because you're battered by a four-year-old. This one, can people see that at the back? Or is that just a little bit too small for... I can read it to you. Why don't you read it to them? Put you on the spot now.
I've got my glasses on. Any harmful act by a child, whether physical, psychological, or financial, which is intended to gain power and control over a parent or caregiver.
What do we think about that definition? Is anyone uncomfortable with that definition?
I don't like it very much.
There's a word in there, isn't there, that kind of just intent?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, look. Yeah. So it's close. But I know some people who would immediately exclude themselves because they say, I don't actually want to put that on my child because I'm not sure that they do. In that moment, maybe in that moment they do, but generally they don't. So the next one is kind of a bit broader. So I'll read this one. Behaviour considered to be violent if others in the family feel threatened, intimidated, or controlled by it, and if they believe that they must adjust their own behaviour to accommodate threats or the anticipation of violence. It's not a snappy. Yeah, the threats of violence, and actually verbal violence, we haven't talked about that, or actually intimidation. You know, a 15-year-old squaring up to you. You know, those kind of things can be really emotive. And then we've had parent battering. So, I think the intended one is really the issue for me. I think I like that snappiness of that one, but I like the broadness of the other one. And I think intended, we talk sometimes around children who've got perhaps FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, that actually some people say, well, actually my child has got brain damage. So actually there is no intent, but they have really struggled with commands, or they struggle with they're regulating themselves. And so actually there is no intent, but I still get punched. A punch is a punch when it comes to, or a threat. So intended, planned, deliberate, premeditated, calculated. In that moment, it might be intended. It might be premeditated. Well, not premeditated. It can't be premeditated. That doesn't work, does it?
No.
But in that moment, it can be quite calculated as well, actually. And some children, they, when once they go over the red line, they can stay over the red line for quite a while. So I think the definition is really important. And I just, what I'm conscious is I meet a lot of people who, I met someone, we gave this last week, and I spoke to someone, and he said to me, well, it's not really us. And then he told me the story of how his daughter would call him an effing so-and-so, and she'd smash plates on the edge of the table, and she's 12. And I was going, what? Yeah, and he said, but I don't feel threatened, but it's pretty scary. And sometimes I'm nervous about talking to her or asking her to do things. And sometimes I feel really, I get quite anxious when I have to say, could you move your socks? Because I know that I might get that. And I said, well, if that was a man and a wife, or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, and if that was an adult relationship, we would call that abusive, wouldn't we? But we wouldn't even blink an eye and say that's an abusive relationship. But it's complex. Next slide. I'm doing all the talking here, aren't I?
I'm just letting you go on with it.
Yeah. Though. Do you want to say anything? Not really.
I'm just adding in as you go.
All right, okay. Don't be shy. I think as well that there's probably a slide that goes before that. I have a feeling that I've missed a slide out.
Yeah. You missed my slide out.
You
deleted it.
That one about taboo.
Yeah.
Do that one.
Well, I can't remember. It's not up there.
All right, I'll do it. Well, I was sat over there before and I was thinking, you know, I've missed a slide out, and actually it's the one that someone, the taboo. And I think that actually this is a huge taboo.
And it is. Yeah. And I think that last week, we spoke last week at a university where they'd actually paid. People had paid to come and listen to these speakers, and there was less people.
They didn't pay us.
No, there was less people in their room than was in this room. So that's, for me, that's proof that we need to do this. Yeah, because people don't really want to pay to hear about this sort of stuff, professionals. But we were talking about taboos. And for the first 18 months that my family was experiencing CPV, as in the physical CPV, so we're talking about, you know, actual, you know, grabbing and punching and kicking and biting. My partner and I didn't acknowledge it with each other. We probably acknowledged it inside, so we knew ourselves and we're thinking, oh, you know, what's going on here? Never heard of it. Knew probably that some people had experienced stuff like that, thinking, oh my God, we've really failed our son because we can't control his violent behaviour. It took us 18 months to acknowledge that this was a thing for us. And this, the kind of the taboo there is about being able to say out loud, actually, do you know what, we, as a family, we suffer from this. It's almost like a condition. We have it, it happens. We have to deal with it. We don't know when it's going to happen. We could have had such a lovely day down the seaside. Everybody's happy. We've had chips, stick rock, whatever. And then we get home and then boom. And that was actually the first time that happened. We had a lovely little static caravan up on the Norfolk coast. And it happened in the caravan the very first time. And I remember thinking, what the hell is this? Because, you know, it was just out of the blue, completely out of the blue. And we were bruised afterwards. We had kind of teeth marks and all that sort of stuff. We didn't know where it came from. To me, that's the taboo of this. Because if we were to sit and tell this to a social worker about how we actually had to physically restrain him that night, we would probably be in a lot of trouble. But we had no choice.
I think for me, it's the reason you hear about flags and red flags and trigger signs. We've experienced exactly the same, that it's just suddenly come out of the blue and you think, what the hell? Mm-hmm. This was a really, really lovely day. You let your guard down and finally go, children are, that's been retiring.
Are they?
And it suddenly hits you like a sideswipe.
Yeah.
And you think, where did that come from? Yeah. Emotionally, you're not prepared.
Yeah. But I think that, I mean, for me, the taboo about us was the fact that we didn't want to acknowledge it because we felt that we had failed because we'd had such, and forgive me for saying this, but our older two, actually, in comparison to 10-year-old, have been no real problem at all. So for us, it was like we'd failed.
Mm-hmm.
We really had failed. We'd failed as parents. We'd failed the older two as well because we'd brought this third child into our house, mm-hmm. and they were witnessing all this kind of behaviour.
And they were saying, you're letting him away with that. We would never have gotten away with that. No, you wouldn't have done that, actually. But then you wouldn't have done it in the first place. Because you come from a different kind of experience and background and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I think one of the key things is that we are hardwired to blame parents for the children's behaviour. So if you go to, if we all went out here, went to Tesco's, and there's a toddler screaming, we go, where's the parent? Where's the parent? And, you know, there'll be the, you know, older people, what that child needs is a good night's sleep. What that child needs, what that child is, everyone's an expert. So actually, when your child is behaving and you actually think, I have no control, I've tried everything in the book, and I bought some new books and tried everything in those books, and I've been on courses, and I can't get them to do what I want. Actually, I'm just ashamed. And you feel very blamed for that, because that's our normal response. You know, we've all sat in soft plays and gone, that child. You know, we've all looked at children and go, where's the parent? Where is the parent?
Oh, it's me.
And it's usually you. It's usually Scott at the end. There's Scott. Oh, he's at the bar. it's turned ugly already. And normally we would get far further down the slides before we get ugly. So I think for parents, but also I think that actually the Home Office guidance, which there is very little, talks about adolescent to parent violence, says that any professional who finds out should call the police. So actually, I don't want to criminalise my 12-year-old. Do you? You know, as much as I don't want to be called, I don't want to criminalise them. I don't want to kind of give them, you know, they've got enough set against them without kind of dragging them through the criminal justice system. But I think the big one, and I think you like this one, is the idea of actually no one mentions it in preparation. We talk about challenging behaviour. We talk about, you know, I'm a social worker, so there's a social worker in the room, when you do referrals for children, and they talk to them having a cheeky little personality, you know, yeah, likes to get their own way. And we think of those in terms of, we think of those through a prism of normal challenging behaviour, but actually, where's the ethics in preparing people to fail? When I first went through the adoption process back in the day, my preparation group, I can remember talking about attachment. So actually, when there was things around attachment, I would say to my social worker, can we talk about attachment? And they'd go, yeah, no, not a problem. But 10 years before that, people wouldn't talk about that because it wasn't on the agenda. So if you said to your social worker, I've got attachment issues, they wouldn't know what you're talking about, or they wouldn't. So you'd be nervous around raising those issues. So actually, we need to, we'll go on to the prevalence later, but we're looking at 30%. In 10 people who are being prepared to adopt, 10 people, 3 of them will experience violence. Right? So in a room full of 10 people going through the process of adoption, or preparing to adopt, we need to say, someone in this room will experience challenging behaviour, and it will look like this. Not a, I don't want to do that, mummy. It's a, jump through the window, I don't want to do that, mummy. And I think that ethical preparation is something that it's a phrase we're banding around.
Is part of the definition also that it predominantly happens in the home only, I mean, within the family unit rather than at school or in other social settings? Is that part of the, I know it's CPV,
yeah,
definition, but is part of the taboo as well, that it is usually within the home?
I think that's right, yeah. Because often people look at children and the children, children living in a world of strategies, aren't they? So they cope in different environments in different ways, but in the home, they often, that's when you get a presentation. So, you know, how many times has a teacher said to you, well, they're a little angel. I have no mother. And you're kind of going, who's going to believe me? Who can believe me?
I don't live in that world today. No.
Well, I don't, but my wife is very. My friend Emma's here. My wife, I'll be very careful what I'm saying because my friend. My wife is very forthright in her telling people what she thinks. I think there's also professional taboo. I think and I'm a champion of social workers, no social workers go into social work to criminalise children. I thought you put your hand up to say, I did. That's shocking. We'll get onto responses, but I think the professional response, I think, as well, is that, do you know when you see, have you ever, like, this is how I do, like, DIY in my house, I kind of go, oh, there's a crack in the wall. tell you what, I'll go and watch telly. Because actually, sometimes it's, if I don't have an appropriate response, sometimes it's easier to kind of just look away or give glib responses. And I think that sometimes it's taboo because I've started to do training with social workers, and I did an adoption and fostering team. And actually, I sat in a room with probably about as many here, and I said, so who's heard of child-to-parent violence? And they all went, well, it's kind of, I understand the words, but not heard of it as a thing. And I said, well, who's heard of... And I explained it out. And at the end, they all said, yeah, we all know what happens. So I've got foster carers, I've got SGOs, I've got birth families, I've got... And they said, yeah, it's actually, it is a massive thing, but we've never sat in a room and talked about it, ever. And I said, right, then we have now, so we can call it a thing. It's a thing. It's a thing that's happening. So that was the slide, that was the phantom slide. Hit the button, Scott. Are we going too fast? I can't tell.
I don't know.
Yeah. Paradigms.
We'll see how we go.
We'll see how we go. We can always cut things out, can't we?
Yeah.
And that links into professional views, because actually the response that you get depends on who you ask. So police see it as a criminal behaviour. It is criminal. If you punch someone, that's assault. If you threaten someone, that's a threat. So often, police can see it in terms of criminal offence. I have to say, my experience with the police has been fantastic. An educational view can see it as, actually, is this a special education needs? Is this just a behavioural issue? Well, I think it's more, it is, we can all probably agree that it's more than just a behavioural issue. It's not, a sticker chart is not going to fix this. If it...
Damn sticker charts, honestly.
How to incite a riot in an adoption room full of adopters.
A sticker chart, so very brief little story. Week before last, because my youngest son is now in year six. For me, just knowing, even if he didn't kick off at school, just them knowing that he does it at home is a support to me. Because I know that actually... I've got lots of friends in the school, whether they're learning support assistants or teachers or even head teachers, so I can go to them and say, this happened, or I've got a bruise, or you know, whatever. But it's a support to me to be able to do that. And it means that someone's acknowledging it as well, a professional is acknowledging it, the same way the police maybe acknowledge it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, my experience with the police, and I'll tell you my police story, is that I... social care, they see it as kind of attachment, child-centred trauma. Actually, the amount of... How many years have been told things like, well, all children do that. It's the terrible twos, terrible threes, and you go, yeah, but the rest of my terrible threes, they weren't throwing chairs at walls and climbing up them. Medical views, actually, that it's actually a medical problem. Maybe it's FASD, but none of those necessarily help. They see the symptom, and they give it a different explanation depending on their perspective. So police sees it as a... maybe it's an offence, but they see it within a context that, or it's behaviour, or it's actually mental ill health. But that doesn't necessarily help, because they might say, well, actually, we'll give you Ritalin. You go, well, you're not fixing anything. You're just making us able to live together. And sometimes that's the best we've got, but that's the way we're at. So we'll move on to the next slide, because honestly, we could just prattle on.
We could tell stories
about, oh, how we laughed. Causes. I think that Dr. Wendy, when she went through all the research and she read everything there was to read about child-to-parent violence, and she said to me, because we call her the puppet master because she writes things and then sends me out to London to talk to people about them. She plays me like a fiddle.
She's now hooked me in as well, which...
So be careful. Actually, post-traumatic stress disorder, the thing that it all boils down to is trauma for a lot of children. But that might be a physical trauma. So children who've been born perhaps with FASD, or they're in the mothers when they were pregnant were taking drugs or misusing alcohol. Genetic, some people are angry people. And there's stuff around Bessel van der Kolk is doing stuff in epigenetics where it's saying that traumatic experiences are passed down generations. We've got attachment issues, so we've got children who've got reactive attachment disorder where actually consequences are irrelevant, or children who perhaps have a disorganised attachment that when stress comes in, they unravel and they don't know what to do, so actually the only response they've got is a physical response. or a verbally abusive response. We could talk about that a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, I'd add to that that there's some things that we've not listed up there, and there's a list as long as your arm. And we all know that our children have triggers, times of year, Christmas, birthdays, Easter, to summer holidays, all that sort of stuff. All that can contribute. But there's also learned behaviour as well. Now, I'm fortunate, I don't know, depends on how you look at it, to have missed the nappy years. So all my children were older, so we didn't have shitty nappies everywhere, which is fantastic, really. But with that comes a lot of learned behaviour. So with Jacob, he has learned his reactions, his responses and his violence from his birth mum, because she was also a child in care. And she was abused and, you know, all the kind of stuff that goes behind that. But he had learned that if you throw a remote control at somebody, you get reaction. Not necessarily the reaction that you think you want, but you get reaction nonetheless. By doing that,
I mean that you would kind of describe that as a disorganized attachment, yeah. Because the person who you're meant to be attached to is the scary person. You're caught in that push me pull me sort of experience.
But on top of that, then you've got things like, you know, there's lots of things. In the previous slide, CAMS, diagnosing incorrectly. Sorry if there's any CAMS people.
CAMS,
but
CAMSes.
Sometimes it's something to say, my child. What does my child have? So we go along to CAMS and we hope for the answer, and then we get the answer and it's ADHD or it's whatever it is. No, he doesn't have ADHD. He's got trauma-centred issues that, you know, we need to deal with. No, he's got ADHD. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you this pill, and that's going to calm him down and everything's going to be perfect. Oh, do you know what? Whatever we can get, we will take. Mm-hmm. We just don't want him to be a vegetable. So the medication made him angry, but when we're doing things like that, we're looking for an answer. We're looking for a solution. And that's maybe just not the answer or the solution.
I think what you said there is really indicative of how desperate you get. I'd literally try anything. If someone said, you know, casting chicken's entrails on the kitchen floor every morning worked, I'd have done it. I have chickens. So we didn't. Just to clarify, I did not, just for the... I did not put chickens on trills, and I think that actually you reach a point of desperation. I remember there was one of the worst times. They're all difficult times, but I think the very beginning was for 6 months, every night at 4 o'clock in the morning, my daughter at 3 would get up and fight me. She wanted to wake the whole family, so I would take her downstairs and I would stand in our kitchen and I'd stand with my back to a door, 4 o'clock in the morning. For an hour, and she would fight me. She would come at me, and she'd throw things at me. She'd bite me. She'd scratch me, and I started to feel my mental health deteriorate. And I'm quite a thoughtful chap, but that desperation, you start to think, what am I going to do? How can I live like this? She's 3, and I think you kind of think, actually, Ritalin seems like a really good option right now because I don't know what other option there is. I can't live like this. You know, how can I survive in an environment where I'm a hostage and I'm frightened? And when I hear a scream in the night, I'm traumatised. I develop my own set of traumas. Let's move on, because we've got loads to get. Oh, how did you do that? There is never just one cause for any complex behaviour. An explanation of someone's behaviour may be in terms of the individual, both genetic, biological and past experience. The family and the wider society, all of these play a part. And that's from children's violence to parents. It's a swirling soup of influences, isn't it? It's never X or Y. It's X and Y and a little bit of Z and some Tuesday and a blue thing. And it's like it's a total swirl. And often our children come with uncertain histories, don't they? You know, I look at my children's biography and I see gaps, you know. We're not sure what was happening, but we think it was okay. Well, no. For one of my daughters, there's a year when no one knows what happened, but there was no social work involvement. So there's huge gaps in all of our children's biographies that influence and create this soup of experience and biology and genes. You do that seamless now, don't you? It's like a power thing for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shall we do a little bit of prevalence, then maybe we could have some questions on what we've talked about so far, and then have maybe a 10-minute break and rattle it off. Actually, nobody knows. Ba-ba! Right, next slide. No one's quite sure because of all of these reasons. It's a taboo. And how do you measure it anyway? How do you measure it? Back to the whole definition. So in 2013, there were 1,892 reported cases of 13 to 19-year-olds committing violence against their parents in London alone. And that statistic also hints at an issue around how we designate it, which again goes back to the taboo. Because actually, we can all understand a frustrated 15-year-old squaring up to their dad because he won't let them wear what's trendy these days. Because he's disrespected his fidget spinner. See, I'm so damn ridiculous, right? So we can all kind of go, yeah, I get that. I was frustrated. I was a teenager. So most of these statistics are around teenagers because no one's counting anything else.
And just on that one as well, that's physical violence. So it's not verbal. It's not, that is reported physical violence because the chances of us reporting verbal... Would you?
Yeah, I got called a name, officer.
Yeah.
I felt very sad. And what did your daughter call you? She called me it.
Yeah.
Parentline reported that between 2008 and 2010, approximately 7% of their calls concerned children's physical aggression in the home. So that's, it's really, that could mean anything, couldn't it? With the figure raising to 15% for verbal aggression, so that kind of was starting to look at. Actually, that's 12,000. Now, this is where it gets a bit interesting because we started to look around and say, well, who actually is measuring adoptive parents? We met John Simmons last week, didn't we? And he said, what did he say? 1968, there was something like, I think there was 25,000 children adopted from care in 1968. Last year in England, there was 4,000. Blah, blah, blah. But I think what we've done is we've boiled that down. We've boiled that down to the most traumatised children, haven't we? And that makes sense. I'm comfortable with that idea. So actually, we've kind of... Adoption isn't what it was, is it? For a lot of people, it's not the happy ever after. It's kind of a tricky ever after. So, using Julie Selwyn's report, Beyond the Adoption Order, 2014, she kind of said, well, actually... A third of adopters describe themselves as really struggling. And those adopters often cite child-to-parent violence as one of the key features of that struggle. And looking through, and there's a reference list at the back, looking through, but no one's quite certain. So the idea is that it actually ranges between 5 and 29% of parents who are adoptive parents. And I think that'll spill to an extent into foster care, SGOs, kinship care, that sort of thing. Yeah. So.
And this isn't new. I mean, these are quite recent figures. But this isn't new. This has been going on for 30 years, maybe a little bit more. And, I speak to people every day who are suffering from it, but I also speak to people who used to suffer from it. And that's a really interesting bit because... These figures are probably more than they were 25, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, because people are more aware of it now because of social media and things like that and support networks and all that kind of thing. So, but let's not kid ourselves. These aren't accurate figures in what's going on in the world. These are only people that are actually coming forward and saying, yes, that happens to me. Yeah.
Because I asked them... The next couple of slides, we talk about the survey that I did. And I put it out to a few friends, and I've got people who, a friend who runs the FASD Trust Network.
Yes.
Network. I can't remember which one, and it's quite important to her.
Network.
She's not that good.
FASD Network.
Network.
I know your friend.
Yeah. Do you?
Yeah,
we should talk later. And she said, I'm sorry, but we can't partake in it because we don't agree with the definition. Really sorry. And we want to, because it's a massive issue. But actually, for most of my parents, I've chatted and I've took a consensus. The idea of intent, because I'm not a researcher, the idea of intent is just a bit too much for most of our families, because they see that their children are vulnerable and they're actually, they've got brains that are damaged. So I said, well, that's fair enough. So those people all immediately remove themselves from that. And a lot of those children are adopted. So actually, we don't know. Judy Selwyn has done some research in 2015 around adolescent-to-parent violence. But it's academic research, so it's behind a firewall. You can't get to it. And actually, it just says, yeah, it's happening. Adolescents are mean to their mums and dads who are adopted. So we'll move on to the next slide. And shall we stop here?
Yeah.
Like a cliffhanger.
Yeah, there's going to be questions now. About
right,
questions.
You can lead the questions around. Just sit over here.
I'm not asking them. Does anybody have any questions for Al after that first section? or no, seriously, does anybody have any questions before we go to a break? No, and then we'll come back.